This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. It's our morning talk program, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we will be inviting your questions about children's health. Throughout the year, we do various programs about health. We have physicians on the show, sometimes people who have various specialties, and others people who are more generalists. We have a family practice doctor who's on every other month, and then occasionally we have people who deal with particular patient populations. And children's health is something that we like to, at least a couple of times during the year, concentrate on. So we're pleased to be able to do that and to have as our guest Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carle Clinic. So this is the opportunity to call in and ask questions about children. Any of the kinds of questions you could imagine asking a pediatrician, you can ask. And the doctor will do his best to see if he can help you out.
I'll do my best.
All right. That's all we ask is that people do their best. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one thing that I wanted to talk about here a little bit at the beginning was the H1N1, the so-called swine flu. I know people don't like the – particularly anybody who has anything to do with raising pork doesn't like that. Anyway, so that's what we try to give it the correct, the H1N1. Among the groups that are urged when vaccine is available, among the groups that are urged to get it, we have pregnant women, we have people who have small children, and then we have some of your patient population. So specifically for the kids, mm-hmm. who is recommended to have the vaccine?
Well, the initial recommendation was that actually we immunize every child 6 months of age and older up to age 24. Actually, that was the initial recommendation mm-hmm. when there was unlimited supply of vaccine. You know, but what they're projecting is there won't be an unlimited supply of vaccine. There'll be some, you know, kind of restriction on vaccinating. So we're going to vaccinate the high-risk people that you mentioned, pregnant, you know, women that are pregnant. Parents who have infants under 6 months of age who can't be vaccinated. I think kids with health problems, chronic diseases, asthma, diabetes, people on aspirin, long-term aspirin therapy. So those groups would be our target groups. Ideally, we'd immunize, you know, the initial population that we really projected to have the most trouble. But probably won't have that, you know, vaccine available to do that.
Yeah.
So, and vaccine probably won't be available till end of October, I would guess, or maybe even November.
Yeah. One recent article that I read, in fact, suggested that there might not even be enough vaccine for all of these people that have been identified, and also it includes healthcare workers,
absolutely.
Those people,
first responders,
mm-hmm. so police officers and mm-hmm. firefighters and paramedics and all those mm-hmm. kind of people, that there might not be enough vaccine even to do all of those people.
You know, I can't predict. There's several companies making the vaccine. If nothing goes wrong, the whole thing with production of vaccines are that, you know, it has to be approved by the FDA, you know, licensed and out there, and there can't be anything, you know, going wrong with the production itself. There was one year where they had one company that had to stop producing a vaccine because there were some contamination issues. Mm-hmm. So you don't know for sure. Yeah. You know, we can speculate all we want. But I think there'll probably be a first, I think there'll be enough for a first round would be my guess.
Yeah.
The nice thing about this flu, it's novel H1N1. So it's not really the swine flu of 1918, okay? And what I've seen over the last 2 months is very mild disease, very mild. Fever, mild cough, some body aches. Nobody really that sick. And so they just came out with a report just in the last day or two about the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to this particular influenza virus. And it's lower than the seasonal flu. So this thing that was projected to be a real significant influenza is turning out to be kind of a weak monster, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think that's good news. It's just that it's coming at a different time of year. It's coming through the, you know, summer months and things of that sort, which is unpredictable, you know, which you wouldn't really normally see for flu.
Yeah.
And it's hitting it at school time and we don't have a vaccine ready.
Well, we have a caller here. Why don't we take them and welcome others, by the way, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana. Line one, hello.
Hello. Dr. Hill, I have a question for you. My son, he's two, and he just started preschool last week, and already he has a runny nose. So I don't know what the protocol is, if I should get him tested for swine flu or watch and see what happens.
Good
question.
And then
I have a second question about nutrition. Just he doesn't eat well, so what I could do to get him to eat, and if I should, you know, think about getting protein bars or protein powder and put it in his food or something. Whatever I can do to help him gain weight. So those are my two questions, and okay. I'll listen off the air.
All right, thank you.
Is he a healthy 2-year-old?
Caller.
I assume your 2-year-old's healthy otherwise. First of all, we're not necessarily testing people for influenza unless they're hospitalized or unless they're showing signs of significant illness or they're at high risk, significant high risk, and we need to kind of get the information up front early and treat early. But the symptoms that you're describing are typical cold symptoms, runny nose, cough, even low-grade fever. And it's very hard to sort out who has influenza from a common cold, other than usually with the influenza, the illness is a little more severe. So you have probably a higher temperature. Most kids actually are going to run 101.5 or higher. And most of the kids I've seen running 102 to 104 temperature. They just look ill, lethargic, certainly don't have any interest in eating. They'll drink a little. Fever comes and goes, but usually more significant symptoms than what you're describing. And if you have a child that's exhibiting those symptoms at 2, I probably would at least call your physician to ask for advice. The other thing that typically happens with the influenza virus, fever's going to last more than 1 or 2 days. Most of the kids I've seen have had a real fever for more like 3 to 5 days. So, typical common cold starts with a runny nose, cough, low-grade fever, and usually the eating and drinking is fine. What I would worry about would be somebody that's not drinking fluids, somebody that's vomiting a lot, not drinking fluids, somebody that's having difficulty breathing fast or struggling to breathe. Those are really warning signs that I think everybody should be tuned into, whether it be influenza or the child with RSV I saw today or the kid with croup that I saw yesterday. So, I think this is just one of these other viruses that we have to kind of be alert for. So,
okay.
Nutrition in a 2-year-old. Generally, the first thing is that experts now are recommending a multivitamin, and I think that covers vitamin D and some other issues that come up with kids' eating habits. The second thing I usually recommend is that, kids have their favorites. I think you really have to be careful about allowing them to overeat in areas where they're their favorites. I think they can consume enough of calories in certain foods to basically exclude other foods from their diet. So you have to be really kind of careful. So a parent's job is to make sure that they're presented with a balanced diet if possible. Some particular problems are soft drinks, juices, goldfish, crackers, those kind of things that are really empty calories. So if you can eliminate those, avoid the favorites, reasonable portions of favorites, then you just turn them loose. And I think your job is to put the foods out there and their job is to eat if they're hungry. One of the things that I think parents probably err on is expecting their kids to eat 3 big meals a day, they kind of push. I think you need to be careful not to push kids to eat. Present the foods, make them, make a pleasant environment at mealtime, enjoy your food, and if they're hungry, they'll eat. There's a book called How to Get Your Kid to Eat But Not Too Much by, I believe her name is Vicki Sauter, and it's really just talks about the parent's job is to provide good nutrition. The kids' job is to eat, and don't get the jobs mixed up. So it's kind of interesting. So
there seems to be this idea that kids will, that somehow they know nutritionally they know what they need, and when they need it, so that they may seem to be eating oddly. That I'm sure that there are a lot of stories the parents will tell that says my child would only eat three things,
Yeah.
Or that that we as adults have this pattern that we think, mm-hmm. well, you have these three mm-hmm. meals a day. Probably most people skimp on breakfast. They don't, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they have a donut and a coffee. Mm. They have something for lunch. The big meal of the day is dinner. Mm-hmm. And then a couple hours after that, we go to bed. And yeah. a lot of people say, you know, that's really actually the wrong, your biggest meal of the day probably should be breakfast or lunch mm-hmm. when you need the energy. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the day, when you're winding down, that's mm-hmm. not when you want to pack all right. you know all these right. calories in. So I think the prevailing wisdom or the old-fashioned wisdom is kind of let kids decide, and they'll do okay. Do you think that that's true?
I think children typically will eat when they're hungry, so their body knows when they need the calories. And I think if they're not hungry, we shouldn't be pushing because that's just the wrong message, wrong cue. I think kids that are nutritionally deprived probably search for certain things, but in general, kids can make some bad choices, you know, especially, you know, school-age kids and teenagers where they tend to really go for the junk and sweets and salt and things. So I'm not sure they always make the best choices. And so parents, that's kind of parents. One of parents' jobs is to kind of teach the kids what good nutrition is, model that in their home. Sit down for meals, avoid fast foods. Those are pretty important things that we're neglecting now. We're all busy, you know. Mm-hmm. We've got soccer and this and that, and people just grab food and this and that. So, and I think overall, I don't think kids will starve themselves. That's one of the things, you know. I think they're going to eventually ease just making sure we have the right stuff out there for them to eat. So,
okay. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carle Clinic, and we're talking about children's health. You have a question about your kids or the kids in your life, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. For a moment, to go back to swine flu, I would just wanted to ask the reason for vaccinating parents who have children who are too young to vaccinate.
Right.
Is that the idea? Is there then the parents won't get it and then right. won't pass it on to the children who right. are too little to be vaccinated?
Right. And are, okay. are particularly high risk because they're 6 months or younger.
Yeah. You know. One of the things that I came across was an article about a study or some information that was put out by the CDC looking at the children who, and they're not a lot, fortunately, but mm-hmm. children who died yeah. as a result of
sure.
H1N1. And one of the things that they found was a third of these kids had no underlying medical condition. Now, if you have a child who does, then mm-hmm. you'd want to pay very close attention to what's going on.
And
if
very
you,
high
if
risk.
You think they're very high risk. Yeah. So if you think something's going on there, you definitely want to get medical attention.
And vaccinated, obviously.
But then the question is, mm-hmm. I think if you are a parent and you have a child that isn't, mm-hmm. you don't know to be mm-hmm. high risk, you know, no, sure. no pre-existing conditions sure. that you would worry about. Well, how vigorous are you and what symptoms, if they're sick, mm-hmm. should really concern you to the point that then you pick up the phone and you call the doctor?
Well, I think if you're worried, that's the first thing. And I think a parent has pretty good sense. At least call if you're worried. I mean, I don't think there's any harm. And then I think a trained professional can sort through the symptoms with you a little better. As far as observing and you know, specifics, I think any child that, as I said, is not able to eat or drink or refuses to drink and has decrease in the amount of urine output and, you know, and that particular situation, I think I'd be very concerned no matter what the illness is. Trouble breathing would be a little more difficult, but anybody that's pulling or tugging or breathing faster than normal would be somebody I'd be concerned about. Somebody that's not able to ambulate would be seriously ill, so somebody that's not going to get up from the couch or, you know, do things that are normal activities would be really, I'd be really concerned about those people. I think the other thing that a lot of the problems with influenza are secondary. So that means that you get the flu, you get, you know, you develop a cough, you develop maybe a little bronchial infection, you get a secondary bacterial infection. Mm-hmm. Those are what really get people, especially young and old or people that are debilitated, neuromuscular diseases, and they can't clear their cough. And the secondary pneumonia is often what gets you. So what happens is you're kind of limping along, doing okay, and all of a sudden you get very, you know, you get acutely worse. That would be a problem for me, somebody that or has a recurrence of fever where they were well for a day or two. That would bother me. So those kind of things are red flags.
Okay. What other recommendations are on what conditions would you think it would be appropriate to use antivirals, something like Tamiflu?
Right, Tamiflu. Tamiflu would be recommended for individuals with neuromuscular problems, diabetes, asthma, and, you know, multiple medications, anybody with a chronic medical condition that might, you know, have problems and more serious problems with the flu, pregnancy, and this and that. Those are the primary targets for treating if someone has flu. Then there are the preventative treatment with Tamiflu where, like, I have a person in my home that has a neuromuscular disease and, you know, they've been exposed. We can treat them prophylactically as well before they get the disease. And that's recommended, too, for certain groups. And you really have to work that out with your physicians, I think. Unfortunately, it looks like for the research that's been done and the studies that have been published in the last month or so on Tamiflu are not very promising in terms of preventing complications or even decreasing the degree of illness to any great extent. So I think the big thing is wash your hands, you know, stay away from sick people, get your flu vaccine, report, you know, your illness if you have more than an, you know, if you have any extreme in your illness, report in. So,
well, I guess for me here, the important point is if you are not a high-risk individual, get your seasonal flu shot.
Absolutely.
If you're a high-risk individual,
get both. Absolutely.
And that as far as something like Tamiflu is concerned, for most people, it would not be prescribed as a prophylactic.
Correct.
It would be given after someone already has flu and that in – I don't know if you would even do that with somebody who you knew had flu but was yet not in one of the high-risk groups.
You do not.
Groups.
Right.
You would not do Tamiflu.
Okay. Well, there's two reasons. One is it doesn't really change the illness much.
Yeah.
And two is what are we going to do if we throw Tamiflu at everyone with influenza? What's going to happen?
It's going to get – the bugs are going to get resistant
Thank
to the
you.
Tamiflu.
And it's already starting.
Yes.
So, you know, I think those all there's a summary from the CDC, quote, persons who are not at higher risk – for complications or do not have severe influenza requiring hospitalization, generally do not require antiviral medications for treatment or prophylaxis, quote unquote. So, okay. And I think we need to abide by that, you know, for all sorts of reasons.
So as far as the vaccine for seasonal flu is concerned, do you know at what point, say, over at your place, you're going to start giving shots?
Hopefully in the middle of this month. I think there's already some venues, like I think Walgreens or some of these stores have already opened up for business. But I think our clinic is probably going to start middle of September, I think, and then I don't know about H1N1.
Okay. And for that, for the seasonal flu vaccine, who do you recommend should have that? Aside from everybody.
Everyone.
Yes.
All people in the age group that I take care of, which would be 6 to 22. I think generally they're just recommending it for the general population, especially high-risk people should not shy away from the flu vaccine. So. Yeah,
okay. And one other question about H1N1. Is the thinking still now that two doses are going to be required, two shots?
They've actually published some studies this month that looked at that, and apparently one dose is going to be somewhat effective. So they may be – I don't know what they're going to recommend, honestly. It's a moving target. I mean, they may recommend that we only immunize that small group or that higher risk group and use two doses and save the vaccine for that group. But then often that's not the greatest strategy sometimes, because vaccine sits around and goes dormant and lays around. But I don't know what they're going to recommend. It looks like you get some immunity with one dose, which is good news.
Okay, and then just generally speaking. What you would recommend for people who would like to increase their chances of getting through the cold and flu season without getting sick, just the very basic sorts of nothing fancy, basic sort of hygiene stuff that you would suggest.
Well, I mean, you can always talk about good nutrition, getting plenty of sleep and rest. Yeah. But if some, you know, I think basically you have to avoid droplets from someone coughing in your face, and also have to avoid touching things that people have basically contaminated. So washing your hands probably has the number one best overall benefit of any one particular strategy. And then hopefully people can learn to cough correctly into their sleeve instead of on their hands or in someone's face. And I think we can probably work with the school kids on that and the great spreaders. It would be helpful.
Great vectors of disease, kids.
Great vectors.
One thing that I'm sure for a lot of parents would be very, very difficult is keeping their kids home if they're sick. But now it seems like, you know, the recommendation that parents are being strongly recommended if they have a child that's really sick and they know it, not to send the child to school.
Yeah, that's a problem. You've got work. You've got school. Yeah. It's a big problem. So we don't really have a good venue for those kids right now. You know, they can't go to their daycare. They can't go to school. Parents have to miss work. It's a big burden. I don't know how people manage necessarily. Sometimes it's difficult if you don't have relatives or if you don't have somebody that's able to come in. You have to miss work. And so I think hopefully the employers will be a little more kind to employees and be a little more forgiving if they do need to stay home with their kids. And, yeah, if the kid's got a fever and a cough, please don't go to school.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carle Clinic. And if you have questions about children's health, could be about cold, flu, but could be about anything else, anything that you could imagine asking of a pediatrician, that's certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just while we're on the subject here, what do you do about fever? How do you treat fever?
Well, first of all, don't use aspirin. I failed to get on my soapbox this year, but aspirin and influenza do not mix, nor does aspirin and chickenpox, with something called Reye syndrome. And I don't think that people remember much. You know, it hasn't been a recent problem because I think we've avoided aspirin pretty well. But if you are on aspirin, this would be a good chance for you to get your flu vaccine. Some people have to be on aspirin for various reasons. So I think the two products available are perfectly fine would be your acetaminophen, which is your Tylenol products, and your ibuprofen, which is Motrin or Advil. I use one or the other. People like to mix and match and do odd schedules. I think just pick one, use it. If it doesn't work, move to the next. Also, consult your doctor on appropriate dosing because most people underdose probably ibuprofen and Tylenol for short periods of time, and they don't get the relief they need.
Yeah.
Be careful, really be very careful with Tylenol, acetaminophen, because a lot of these over-the-counter products that you can still get, which really bug me, have acetaminophen in them. So you've got Tylenol, cold and cough, and you've got – and there's been some serious liver damage done and people that didn't realize they were kind of double dosing
On the Tylenol.
Tylenol is lethal.
Yeah, and it's something that we've seen in adults as well for that very reason. You know, you feel terrible, you take some Tylenol, and then you take some other product,
right?
And it has all this stuff. It may have Tylenol in it. Yeah. It may have antihistamine and decongestant, and you know, they pile all this stuff to treat all these different symptoms in there. And people are not reading the box carefully enough to see that, and it can be a real problem.
I'd like to do a quiz and see how many people really feel that Tylenol can be toxic or know that it can be very toxic. And I just think people, it's such a common product out there and so safe, but actually if you're really not taking correct amounts, it can be irreversible in terms of liver damage and death. So it's not a great one. Remember, also, according to all research that's done every 10 years, cold and cough medicines really don't do much for kids' colds. So I don't have any use for them and don't recommend them. Save your money.
All right. We have some callers. Let's talk with someone in Terre Haute. And this is – no, they changed their mind. How about Champaign? Line one. Hello. Yes.
Yes. My question is they're giving the flu shot very early this year.
Yeah.
Are you going to be covered in February, March? by getting it in September. Mm-hmm. They usually give it in October.
I wish we knew when the flu was going to hit. And sometimes it does hit early. Sometimes it hits late. And probably later in the season, the immunity may wane some, but you'll still get some protection. So I think that's the key.
I know the reason is because they want to have the H1N1. Yeah, if you have to get that, then, you know.
Yeah, exactly. One thing you could do, I'm not going to advertise for any particular, I'll get in trouble here. There's a flu vaccine called FluMist, which is a nasal spray. It's it's a live attenuated virus, and I think probably get a slight advantage of that in terms of efficacy and longevity of the immune response. So that's one thing you could consider. But it's if you have health problems, certain health problems, it's not something you can use.
Yeah, I don't have. The other thing is, would you recommend that children take ibuprofen then rather than the acetaminophen?
Well, not necessarily. I think acetaminophen is perfectly safe if used in appropriate doses.
Other combination of
Yeah, or the incorrect dose. There was, I mean, there's difference. The other problem with some of the medications is, you know, you get Tylenol in this strength or that strength. Mm-hmm. Drives me crazy because you can make errors. Somebody might tell you to take this many teaspoons when actually you need mLs, milliliters. So you got to be really careful. And I think if you are, it's perfectly safe. Ibuprofen, sometimes some of those non-steroidal anti-inflammatories can cause GI upset and occasionally end up with a GI bleed. So they're not, Tylenol is reasonable.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Charleston, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering, what are some of these underlying conditions that are causing two-thirds of the children to die with H1N1?
I didn't see the list, but they mentioned neuromuscular. So most of the kids that I've seen are kids with cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy or have had a spinal cord injury where they can't – where their respirations are a little compromised. They don't clear their secretions as well. They don't cough as well. That group would be particularly high risk.
What about asthma?
Asthma, I think if you're uncontrolled asthma, if your asthma is not under good control, you would be at risk as well for pneumonia and lower respiratory infection. But if your asthma is very well controlled and you're, aware of signs and symptoms of your asthma deteriorating and get right on it, you're probably at higher risk, but not like these kids. And I haven't seen the list specific, the specifics, but I think that's probably a fair assumption.
Okay. And does the regular flu shot
help? Can I mention one other thing? So if you're also high risk, they mention, the flu vaccine, but also make sure that those routine immunizations for pneumococcal disease, Hib disease, are certainly things that have been done, because that is where a lot of the pneumonias are. They're pneumococcal. So.
Okay. And does the regular flu shot do anything to prevent H1N1?
Not that we're aware of. I think it's that the flu shots are very specific for very specific strains of flu. And this one's novel or unique. It doesn't have the same antigens as the seasonal flus we're going to see. So, no, it doesn't provide, as far as I know, any protection.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our guest this morning on Focus 580, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carl Clinic. You know, it seems that with some of the colds that I've had over the last few years, a thing that's really dogged me is nighttime cough.
Cough, yeah.
And I can be, okay, maybe not great, but okay during the daytime. Mm-hmm. But as it gets later into the evening, it starts to become more of a problem. And then at the point where I try to lie down and go to sleep, it's killing me. And, I have tried the standard over-the-counter stuff, which sometimes seems to work and sometimes not. And I'm afraid you just kind of have to tough it out. And it can be really bad. So when it comes to kids, I hear what you're saying, and I guess my experience with the liquid medicines that are supposed to be cough suppressants, they really don't work very well. What do you do?
Well, I think, first of all, what's the normal course of a cold? I think you need to understand that. So typically, you're going to have some cough, runny nose, congestion for 10 to 12 days. And you know, normally if it goes beyond that, you should start at least looking for complications, sinus infections, bronchial problems. So understanding that. And so most kids get through the first 5 to 7 days, you know, with a cough that's tolerable. When I start hearing waking up at night with cough, I'm always going to make sure that the kids are not suffering from other problems, because a lot of times if you can't sleep with the cough, you're going to find that kids have mild bronchitis, asthma, sinusitis, or whatever. So I would at least consider those problems if I'm having real trouble sleeping at night. If it's a little cough and tickles and wakes you up, you know, I think pretty much most of the over-the-counter products, very little benefit. They've studied them carefully, done head-to-head with two other therapies. One is water. Okay, water works about as well as Robitussin with codeine. And the latest study, don't laugh at me.
Other than
chicken soup, 2 teaspoons of honey.
Okay.
And seriously, that worked better head-to-head than anything they found over-the-counter.
Yeah.
So go ahead and laugh at me. But
okay. I was just saying, okay, that's
soup
fine
and honey.
If you want to slip me a couple of opioids.
Yeah.
I'd still take that.
I'm not going to do that.
Okay, not going to do that. Very good. I was thinking about the fact that it seems like when I was a kid, particularly in the winter and cough and cold season, one of the sort of standard things that people did was they used I was going to say vaporizers.
Oh, vaporizers, sure.
As if somehow dry air was a problem, and by putting more moisture in the air, that would somehow helped.
Well,
is there any evidence that, in fact, that shows that does
okay.
help?
You want science here? Oh, geez. Okay. Well, there is some science. Proper humidity in a home can do a couple things. One is it's probably healthy for the respiratory tract to have proper humidity. Dry mucous membranes are not as able to defend themselves. And two, viruses live longer in dry or arid environments.
Yeah.
So actually, the spread of viruses will be reduced a little bit by proper humidity in the home. That's all the evidence I have. You got to be kind of careful with what you aerosolize, though. If you're looking at some of these products, the cool misters, if you put water with a lot of minerals or contaminants, it generates aerosol with a lot of particles and it can irritate your asthma and sometimes your upper airway. And then, of course, you can have contamination of some of the other products. They have water with mold and things of that sort. So be kind of careful if you're doing that to make sure everything's clean and you're using clean water with not, you know, with limited amount of minerals if you're going to kind of nebulize or aerosolize.
You thought I was going for the
yeah, I did.
The Vicks on the lip.
Vicks
under the nose. Well, let's talk about that.
Okay. Actually, I'll say do no harm with Vicks. I've heard people putting it on their feet, everything, but do not put it under the nose, and especially do not put it on an infant. They always have published studies. These are always great, but they studied this, and it was out east, and they found that infants that were exposed to the Vicks vapor rub, if it was on their upper chest or around their nose or face, had respiratory distress, because what happened was the young infants developed a lot of nasal congestion, actually from the irritation and upper airway irritation, and they ended up having respiratory difficulty, and some of them had to be hospitalized. So don't use it in infants. But other than that, I won't complain.
So the best
thing, eat it. Don't eat it.
I've seen,
it's not for ingestion. I don't know.
I guess, you know, you would have to say that the standard advice should be, if it has a product that it says, this is not intended for internal use, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the best thing that we can do is make sure people get well hydrated, make sure that you're maintaining good levels of nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
If you got a fever, you can treat that with
Tylenol, ibuprofen,
no aspirin. And then it sounds like a lot of the other stuff, and, you know, you go into the pharmacy or, you know, where grocery store or wherever, you got this huge aisle full of stuff that treats symptoms of cold and allergy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pick your product, pick your mix of stuff. There's a tremendous amount of stuff that most of that you would say, well, you know, it's
minimal benefit.
Minimal benefit.
And then if you have allergies, though, I think there's definitely benefit from the antihistamines and some of the allergy products, though. So that's different.
And that is an entirely different thing. Yeah. Have you found we have these and we have an antihistamine like Benadryl. It's been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, for a lot of people, it has one problematic side effect. It makes people drowsy. That actually, depending on what you're looking for, maybe might help, mm-hmm. because some people mm-hmm. find that actually if before bedtime they pop a couple of those, it actually helps them sleep. And mm-hmm. their Tylenol PM, that's what it is. It's Tylenol and it's Benadryl in it. We now have some that are anti-sedating.
Non-sedating.
That try to address that issue. At the same time, I think some people say they actually don't work very well. And what's your experience with the non-sedating antihistamines?
Well, there's the non-sedating and limited sedating. So, actually Benadryl head-to-head works as well or better for purposes of an antihistamine than probably anything out there. But the sedation's an issue, and also the dosing. Benadryl probably has to be taken every 4 to 6 hours. So some of the newer antihistamines are either minimally sedating or non-sedating, and they work for 24 hours, sometimes a little longer. And for most people, I think they'll find one that works. There's 3 or 4 out there, that some new ones too, that work reasonably well. For allergies, also those allergy nose sprays, those topical corticosteroids work pretty well, and actually probably would be first line for a lot of the nose symptoms, if you will. So,
but I guess something maybe people should keep in mind is the symptoms that are a result of a cold and the symptoms that are a result of an allergy, it's not the same thing. So something that's intended to treat allergy symptoms, if you have a cold,
probably not going to do very much. Try you out a little bit, but typically if you get a cold, I'm kind of achy, don't feel well, a little sore throat, followed the next day by some congestion, cough, and maybe low-grade fever. And that's a cold versus my nose itches, I'm congested, my eyes itch, sneezing. I mean, that's probably more likely to be allergy. So likely.
Well, we have about 10, 12, 13 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carle Clinic, and we're talking about children's health. We're talking very much about seasonal topics here, but anything else, the kind of thing that... Let me give the phone number real quick. Anything you could think of asking a pediatrician, that's fair game, and the doctor will do his best. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455.
All right, Gardasil. Controversy.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, I think the controversy is, one thing. And then there's the new information on this. Of course, they've just now looked at Gardasil for males and published the data that it does work. So that may be something that you may be reading about in the near future, is that we'll find out. But Gardasil might be actually recommended for males as well as females to prevent HPV. Well, it makes sense to me, since males are often the great spreader as well. And so I think that's something that'll be probably up there to look at. As far as girls go, the biggest problem with Gardasil has been basically fainting. It's not a life-threatening condition, but what's happening is, I think it's a little uncomfortable. The vaccine's a bit more uncomfortable when they give it. And so there's some discomfort, that may be more than the average vaccine. And teenagers are known to kind of faint more easily than as a group. And especially if they haven't had breakfast or lunch, or this is typical. I had someone in today. Have you had breakfast? No. So we're not going to do Gardasil. And so they tend to faint more with this particular vaccine. So the precautions are, if you're going to, provide Gardasil, make sure people have had plenty breakfast, lunch, or whatever, not skip meals, not dehydrated, and wait around 20 minutes after the vaccine, if possible, at least be attended, because there's a little higher incidence of just plain fainting with this vaccine. So that's not rare.
And now, is this injection anxiety, or is something actually physiological?
It's hard to say, but there are people that faint easily, first of all. There are people that faint when they stand up or feel weak or dizzy and they have to sit down. So there's physiology related to this. So fainting generally occurs more when there's pain or you see something that's traumatic or gory or you perceive pain or, whatever it might be. And it's a physiologic state, but it's probably develops somewhat from the central nervous system as well as when you stand up. And this happens when you're standing up. Your blood volume tends to drift to your lower extremities and doesn't get back up to the heart fast enough to keep your blood pressure up. So your normal response is, I want to lay down here. Uh-huh. So your brain tells you to, you know, lay down by becoming dizzy or fainting. So it's a mixture of things. Certainly poor hydration doesn't help. I think that's why, you know, not eating breakfast, not having plenty of fluids. One of the things that my wife, who's a nurse practitioner, brought me was to she said that one of the GYN specialists in a different field, they go ahead and give juice prior to doing a procedure on young women to prevent this. So that, in other words, they have their juice box and then they do their immunization or procedure, whatever, and that might be something that we ought to consider for the Gardasil too. So.
Is it usually something that you give the shot when the person is standing up?
No, but they walk. You know, they'll get their immunization, have their immunization, then they go out to the lobby
and say, "Okay, we're done. See you later." And they go out.
Yeah, wow. And then bam, okay. You know, down they go. So
we have a couple callers here. Let's go to the first in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a 4-year-old boy, and it seems to have calmed down a little bit, but he has been complaining about itchy skin a little bit, but the weird thing is he would have almost like little blisters come up on his skin, but then disappear.
Ah, those are called
no regular shape at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they were long like a welt, or sometimes they were round, but then you'd look 5 minutes later and they'd be gone.
Right. Well, you're describing, it's perfectly describing something called hives or urticaria. So those are, you know, these welts that come up. Welt is a perfectly acceptable term. They pop up, they itch, and they go away. Sometimes they stay for minutes or hours, but they'll go away and pop up somewhere else. So. So that's called urticaria, hives, welts. There are many causes. I couldn't really tell you, but I can list them. I mean, it's typically foods, medications, infections, occasionally like allergies to pollens and things of that sort. So there's multiple causes. I couldn't tell you. Antihistamines can be used short term to treat these hives. A lot of times, if you don't know, like if you know for sure that he ate peanuts or had strawberries and it broke out, and then if you had a cause, obviously avoidance is the best method of treatment. But if you don't know exactly what's going on, he's not on any medications or anything, and no obvious infections. And a lot of times, what we do is we just treat with antihistamines for a week, and if they still are having problems, then come in and go over it with a physician.
Well, it seems to have calmed down, but it was just good. Such a strange thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, when you start looking for causes, if you don't come up with a cause after talking with somebody first round, most of the time you don't end up finding a cause and it goes away on its own. But I think it's worth knowing the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
All right,
well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And to another caller, also Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I was just wondering, I had a 6-year-old. He just started grade one at a new school, and I don't know if it's a coincidence, but he also had quite a large canker on the inside of his mouth, and he was a good week. I debated going over to convenient care, to see what I should do because it felt like it was growing, but then yesterday it seemed to calm down, and he's able to eat regular food, but I had him on yogurt for about a week. And I was just wondering if I should have been doing some more, oral hygiene or something like that, or was it stress or just coincidence?
I'm not sure if you ever had him before.
No. My other son had one last year, and they're at the same school. I don't know. Well, he's 6, and my other son was 10. Are they in conjunction with a virus sometimes?
Well, stress is always kind of implicated in all sorts of things, including oral ulcerations.
Yeah.
I think, just normal hygiene. I think when you end up with one of these ulcers, they're going to be pretty sensitive, to salt, salty food, sour, toothpaste, anything. So
orange juice.
Oh, yeah. So just, pretty much bland diet, rinse the mouth out carefully after eating. Sometimes if you mix a concoction of Benadryl with Maalox and make a little one-to-one suspension and just kind of put it on there with a Q-tip and wait about 20 minutes, it'll cause a little bit of local anesthesia there, if you will. It'll numb the area up.
Oh, yeah.
And that can be used because they're just going to heal on their own. I think there's some fancier products out there, but they're going to heal within a week to 10 days usually.
Okay. I thought about getting Oragel, but then I thought, well, I'll just wait.
Yeah, I think Oragel is kind of another topical anesthetic, but I think any of those products are just going to give you time, you know, pretty much till it heals. I don't know of anything that you could do to prevent. Maybe stress was the cause, or at least maybe a trigger, but I don't think there's any specifics here in terms of prevention. So
just random. Everybody gets one.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I just wanted to make sure I should have been getting Oragel or something like that.
No, I think you're okay. So.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Good day.
Well, thanks.
I'm enjoying
the program.
Very good. Thank you. And others, if you have questions, we certainly have time for one or two. A couple minutes left here with Dr. Hill. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You were talking just a moment ago about Gardasil.
Yes.
The vaccine for the human papilloma virus.
Right, HPV.
Causes genital warts, and also some of these have been implicated in genital cancers in women.
Cervical cancer. So there's two vaccines. One of them both of these have the serotypes that are responsible for most of the cervical cancer. Mm-hmm. Not 100%, but most of them. So they'll be upgrading these vaccines as we go along. And so really the impetus is to treat the girls because of cervical cancer. And it is very effective.
And I think that there are some other countries already where the recommendation also is that boys.
Well, I don't know for sure. Maybe.
I thought for sure that somehow I want to say Australia.
Could well be.
There was somewhere.
Down under.
Somewhere else. So, somewhere else where they actually had taken the step and recommended for boys. So, and that's what here we are looking at.
Yeah, the FDA has to approve vaccines and their use. So they're just now looking at, they found that it's efficacious. Now they have to decide whether it's going to be licensed for that purpose. And then it's got to go to committees that really recommend our vaccination schedule, our committees on immunizations. And then they'll be the ones that will recommend to me and to you what you should be doing with the vaccine. So there's several steps. But I would imagine it'll be approved and
so
it'll land in our schedule. Yeah,
it will end up. So now, and what is the, at what age are you now recommending this?
I don't know what for boys where the land. Girls, you can be as young as 9 and as old as 26. And I think they're going to extend the upper age limit because they found that it is efficacious, but it's not quite as effective, but it's still efficacious. So.
Okay. Anything else that you might just like, I tell you what, we got a caller here.
Okay.
Let's do that. And maybe we can, let's for sure get the caller. We have somebody here on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. I bought a Bartlett pear at one of the supermarkets, and since I'm diabetic, I needed to have some sugar, so I ate it. And then on the way home, my upper lip became tingly and numbish.
Oof.
And I washed it off.
Yeah.
And about a week and a half ago, and I'm still aware of my upper lip, which is, and I was that a pesticide? Because I had gotten that before years ago when I was taking down a outdoor lantern and that I had sprayed with insecticide the year before. And I put the screw in my mouth like you do, and it had the same thing. So I was wondering, was there anything I should have done besides what I did?
Well, I guess if you just have tingling and not a lot of swelling, it's probably no big risk. But I think there's something called oral allergies, where, you basically have oral symptoms, around your mouth, in your mouth, with contact with certain allergens. And a lot of times it is fruit. So I'd probably, probably consult your physician on that just to be sure, because I don't have any other great explanation.
Yeah. There's no antidote for that kind of stuff, I suppose.
No, but if you had a significant swelling, I think,
I didn't have swelling.
Okay.
I just had this kind of a
tingly, warm. Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think there's any antidote, but I think probably avoid pears until otherwise notified. So,
well, I've learned my lesson. I'm going to wash them.
And wash them for sure. Yeah,
yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm an older guy, so I spend years not washing stuff just because
I know.
You know, one of those things.
I know.
All right.
Have a good day.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Something you want to make sure that we talked about?
Oh, it was interesting. They published studies in various order. And, of course, with our country, we've seen this kind of epidemic of obesity. And some of it relates to our lifestyle and some of it relates to our diet. And lifestyle is, you know, kids are less active now. You know, they're not walking to school. They're not playing outside as much. They're playing video games. Their thumbs are getting lots of exercise. And I've been really critical of, I guess, TV and video games. But of late, they've really looked at the energy expenditure in kids that play some of these active games, like the Wii or the Xbox or the dancing. And actually, there's some benefit. So I'll kind of get off my soapbox. But if you're looking at activities for the winter months and your kids can't find anything to do, and they don't want to go out in the cold. And, you know, if you have these active, if you will, video games, they actually have been somewhat beneficial. And maybe that's, instead of fighting them, I might join them on this one. But as far as, and then the next study was cool. They did one where they compared the video game to the real game. Guess what? Real game still wins. That was just funny, you know. They got Grant to study what energy expenditure in, like, video bowling versus bowling.
Versus real bowling.
Or video soccer versus soccer. Now, come on.
So anything that, where you're just sitting there on the couch, something that requires some physical expending energy is better than just sitting on the couch. But then, of course, actually playing tennis is better than playing tennis on your Wii.
That's right. Yeah, and drinking my milkshake and playing my Wii is probably not as good as
And so what we leave folks with is wash your hands. Cover your mouth.
Cover your cough.
Cover your cough. And not with your hand, but...
in your sleeve, in your armpit. I think, you know, generally if you're sick, have a fever and a cough, stay home. Don't spread your wealth. And if you really are sick and you're worried, call. Talk it over with your healthcare professional of some sort to see if your symptoms warrant a visit. If you're at high risk, certainly, and get those flu vaccines done. Get her done.
All right. Very good. Our guest, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's pediatrician at Carl Clinic. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Dave.